Welcome to OnClive On Air. I'm your host today, Ashlyn Wehner. OnClive On Air is a podcast from OnClive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, OnClive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Taiho Pharmaceutical, Lipika Goyal, MD, an Associate Professor of Medicine Oncology in the University Medical Line at Stanford Medicine in California, moderated an OnClive Insights webinar on best practices for using FGFR inhibitors in patients with cholangiocarcinoma and moderating adverse effects in this patient population. Goyal was joined by Katie Kelly, MD, a professor of clinical medicine in the Department of Medicine, Hematology Oncology, and an affiliated faculty member in the Cancer Immunotherapy Program at the University of California, San Francisco, Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. Caroline Kuhlman, NP, a nurse practitioner at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And Chandra Bishop, a patient with cholangiocarcinoma. In this exclusive conversation, Goyal, Bishop, Kelly, and Kuhlman discussed the current roles of the FGFR inhibitors pemigatinib and futibatinib in the cholangiocarcinoma treatment paradigm, common adverse effects associated with FGFR inhibitors, ways to counsel patients so they are prepared for the adverse effects they may experience while receiving FGFR inhibitors, and patient-provider communication barriers that still exist in this area.
Hi, welcome to OnClive Insights and to this webinar on FGFR inhibitors, on best practices for managing treatment and treatment-related adverse events. It's really my pleasure and honor to be part of this panel. My name is Lipika Goyal, and I'm a medical oncologist at Stanford Cancer Center. I'm the director of gastrointestinal malignancies, and I have been focusing on hepatobiliary cancers.
So my name is Katie Kelly, and I'm a GI medical oncologist at UCSF, Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center in San Francisco. And I also focus on hepatobiliary cancers and have been involved in some of the clinical trials leading to recent approvals of FGFR inhibitors.
My name is Caroline Coleman, and I am an oncology nurse practitioner in the Tucker Gosnell Center for Gastrointestinal Cancers at the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center. And I'm delighted to be here today to talk with this panel about this important topic. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. So excited to be here with you all. My name is Chandra Bishop. I am a cholangiocarcinoma patient. I was diagnosed about 7 years ago. And so I am thrilled to see these new treatments come to market. When I was diagnosed, there was nothing but the standard care of chemo. And so to now be able to have these different treatment options and inhibitors, I'm thrilled. I'm excited to be here and talk about it and share my experience.
I think that's a great perspective, Chandra, that, you know, where we were 5 years ago and 10 years ago is so different from where we are today. And we had our first FDA approval in cholangiocarcinoma in 2020, and it was an FGFR inhibitor. And there's been so many new drugs that are in development in cholangiocarcinoma. There's a lot more hope for patients when they're diagnosed with this disease. So let's move now on to second-line treatment, where it is on label for FGFR inhibitors to be used. So if we have a patient who has progression on gemcitabine and cisplatin and either durvalumab or pembrolizumab, and they have an FGFR2 fusion, we have two FDA-approved options. One is pemigatinib, and the other is futibatinib. So let's talk about these different FDA-approved therapies. So with pemigatinib, that was the first drug to get approved. That was in 2020. That had an overall response rate of 35.5%. And overall response rate was the primary endpoint. That was a trial where patients with FGFR2 fusions or rearrangements were treated with pemigatinib after at least one line of systemic therapy. And we're encouraged by that overall response rate because we know that in all comers with biliary tract cancer, irrespective of their target status for FGFR2 fusions or otherwise, the response rate with second-line FOLFOX is 5%. So we were happy with this targeted therapy to see such a high response rate. The progression-free survival was around 7 months. And then futibatinib is a second FGFR inhibitor. It's a little different than pemigatinib in that futibatinib is a covalently binding inhibitor. pemigatinib is a reversibly binding inhibitor. They're both ATP competitive. And with this different mechanism with futibatinib of binding, where it binds the cysteine residue in the ATP binding pocket, the thought there is that it can bind more tightly to the receptor. And in preclinical studies, it can actually overcome some of the resistance mutations that we see after treatment with FGFR inhibitors. So gatekeeper mutations, molecular brake mutations, and this may be related to its potency. And the response rate with futibatinib in the Phoenix CCA2 study, which is also in patients that had cholangiocarcinoma with an FGFR2 fusion or rearrangement, and was also a trial in patients who had refractory disease and had at least one line of prior systemic therapy. In that trial, the response rate was 42%, and the progression-free survival was around 9 months. And so overall, we were encouraged by the data for these two drugs. We know that there is a double-edged sword with the different drugs that we're giving in that they certainly kill cancer cells, but they also have side effects. Caroline, you treated a lot of patients with FGFR inhibitors. Can you share with us the counseling that you do for patients before you put them on an FGFR inhibitor?
I think the first piece that's really important to impress upon patients is because these are oral agents and they can take them at home, they tend to think or have the impression that they'll be easier to tolerate versus the chemotherapy they may have gotten previously. So it first is to discuss that there are real side effects associated with these drugs. They can be mild, but they can also be severe and they can affect many, you know, body systems, right? From head to toe. So they can be associated with ocular toxicities, changes in vision, blurred vision, mucositis, sores in the mouth, dry mouth, alopecia, a lot of skin changes, nail changes, bowel changes, electrolyte changes with hyperphosphatemia. And all of these toxicities, they can be mild, but they can also be quite severe and impacting someone's quality of life significantly and making it hard to continue on the therapy. So we like to explain to patients what to expect, what is worrisome, and what to report early, and giving them a full range of sort of what's normal and what's an immediate call.
I think that's a great overview of all the different side effects, Caroline. You know, it's an oral therapy, so we can sort of be lulled into feeling that these drugs are easily well tolerated. And for the most part, people do well on them if we can be really active about symptom management, but it's really important, as you're saying, to share with patients what to expect so they can inform us about when they have early side effects so we can intervene early.
I also would add that there are also things we can help people sort of do in advance to help prepare to make the symptoms not as severe. And then also counseling them that unlike chemotherapy, where they might have acute symptoms right after their infusion that may get better in the days that follow, with the continuous dosing where you're taking the medication daily for 3 weeks in a row, they don't get a break from those. And so optimal management and preparation for that is so important.
Yes, indeed. Great. So to sort of also flesh out how frequently we see some of these side effects, as Caroline mentioned, hyperphosphatemia is one of the most common side effects that we see with FGFR inhibitors. The different FGFR inhibitors that are currently FDA approved are pan-FGFR inhibitors. So pemigatinib, it inhibits FGFR 1 through 3 potently and wildly at FGFR 4. Futibatinib inhibits FGFR 1 through 4 potently. And we're aiming to inhibit FGFR 2 because patients have FGFR 2 fusions, but an on-target but off-tumor effect is that we inhibit FGFR1, and then that impacts the ability of the kidneys to waste phosphorus and also leads to more holding on to phosphorus in the gut. And so patients get hyperphosphatemia. That is seen in about 60 to 80% of patients that get FGFR inhibitors. Patients who are on a drug that is continuous dosing, like futibatinib, the rate of hyperphosphatemia is higher. In patients who are on a drug that has discontinuous dosing, like pemigatinib, there's 2 weeks on and 1 week off, and they have that 1 week break, the rate of hyperphosphatemia is a little bit lower. Then we see diarrhea, which is partly due to FGFR4 inhibition. that is seen in about 20 to 50% of patients. Nail toxicities, we sometimes see nails start to become brittle. They start to break sometimes. People can get paronychia or inflammation and infection around the nail beds. The nail toxicities are seen in about 20 to 60% of patients. As Caroline mentioned, people can get blurry vision. And so it's important to do an ophthalmologic exam at baseline because people can get retinal detachment and central serous retinopathy. And the blurry vision, it occurs roughly in about 10% of patients based on the trials, but the range is 3 to 24%, depending on which drug and which trial. And then Caroline also mentioned that patients can get mouth sores or stomatitis. This can certainly range from as low as 7% up to 58%. People get dry mouth and dry eyes, seen in about 20 to 45% of patients. There's also the skin toxicities where people can get dry skin or rash sometimes with the FGFR inhibitors. People can have hair loss in about 20 to 30% of patients, depending on the trial, even up to 50% of patients. And then these drugs are tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and they can get hand-foot syndrome or palmar plantar erythrodysesthesia in about 5 to 33% of patients. So there's a whole spectrum of different side effects that it's important to talk to patients about, but with proactive management, we can really help these drugs be more tolerable. What are some of the serious adverse events you've seen, Dr. Kelly, with this class of drugs?
We haven't seen too many serious adverse events that are truly causally related by the drug, any of the FGFR inhibitors that I've used to date. Honestly, we've had a couple of patients with rashes that are grade 3 or potentially hypersensitivity type reactions, but those are rare. Other than that, there's the theoretic risk of calcium phosphorus deposition in organs. It is a theoretic concern when you have a drug that causes hyperphosphatemia. We've had a couple of patients get subcutaneous deposits or vascular deposits of calcium on imaging, but none that have caused an SAE to date. It's very hard to establish causality in some of those findings. We've had several patients on FGFR inhibitors get rapidly progressive cataracts, either at the end of treatment or soon after discontinuing. And we've worked with our ophthalmology colleagues. And while it's not fully understood, it is known that FGFR2 plays a role in maintaining clarity of lenses and that potentially removal of the inhibition could cause upregulation. The mechanism is not known. It is known that FGFR2 is vital in multiple compartments of the eye, and cataracts is a rare risk that is now included in the investigator brochure and the package inserts for these drugs.
Thank you for that. Chandra, you've been treated with some of these FGFR inhibitors. Can you share with us your personal experience of being on these drugs?
From my experience, when you pulled up that chart of all the side effects, I was like, yes. Yes, yes. I've pretty much experienced them all. The discussion around side effects was most thorough between my care team and I was when I was part of a clinical trial. They took a lot of time to help me understand the most common side effects and some that maybe weren't as common. Meanwhile, with the standard chemotherapies, it was somewhat breezed through, like, oh, you may, you know, have some nausea, some GI issues. Looking back on it, it was definitely less robust conversation around side effects. And even though these side effects are mentioned, we don't discuss a lot about how they will manifest. For example, they said, oh, you'll have some nail changes, but never really discussed what those changes would look like or how they would appear. I've also been impacted by the high phosphorus levels. And so I wish they sort of informed me prior to that, oh, you know, these are some things that you can do to keep the levels lower, like watching what I consume. Some advice I'd offer to other patients is to ask what you could do prophylactically as it relates to these side effects or toxicities, and just getting a really good understanding about, like, when they say, oh, you might experience neuropathy. Well, what is neuropathy? Like, is that permanent? How long does it last? When should I tell you that it is a problem? That sort of thing. And so I think that discussing side effects is very important, and discussing how they could appear.
That guidance is so helpful for us, Chandra. What I'm hearing from you is it's certainly not enough to just say, oh, your phosphorus might go up or you might have some meal changes. Really going into specifics about what that means for your life and how you're going to feel and what the treatments are going to be and, you know, what to look out for more specifically is certainly more helpful than sort of a laundry list of possible side effects.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Taiho Pharmaceutical. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.